Welcome back to Louder with Crowder. My next guest, we thought, what was the best way to round out the end of the year here? And we had to have on one of our all-time favorite guests. You can find her all over the interwebs. You can read her books. Nearly every book she releases is best-selling. MichelleMalkin.com. Michelle Malkin, thank you so much for being back.
Well, thanks for having me.
I'm always glad to have you on. Now, we were talking about this. Your kids are growing up, right, and it's Christmas, so do you find as a parent, is Christmas less fun than it used to be, or does it just sort of transition into something else?
Well, yeah, it's definitely we're at the transition stage. My daughter's 14 now, and my son is 11, and sort of had the revelation on his own that Santa was not real. That's okay. It's all good. It's a little bit melancholy for me to get to this stage. On the other hand, they're becoming young adults, and that's just another step in this wonderful journey of parenthood.
Right. I know. Well, you seem to have raised some fine young adults. I don't mean to get personal, but I've obviously spent time with a family. And, it's funny in this industry, you know this, Michelle, you can meet so many phonies. So having spent time with your family to see that you guys are true blue and just, you know, they actually like you guys. They actually like their parents and you like your kids. It's a rarity. So you must be doing something right.
Well, that's the best Christmas gift of all, and I have to say, and I'm not sucking up here, Stephen, but they are huge fans of yours, so we must have done something right, right?
No, that makes me question everything I've just said. I think you're just, if you're showing them any of my content, you've made a horrible mistake. But so speaking of content, so you've written a lot of, I mean, there's so much to talk about this week. We have North Korea and Seth Rogen and James Franco, but here's one thing, obviously. You wrote about Jeb Bush. Lot of different viewpoints on Jeb Bush running. Some people are thrilled, of course, and some people think he's establishment type. You wrote about this. What's your take on Jeb Bush? I guess, do we officially call it exploratory time now? I don't know.
Yeah, well, that was his announcement on Facebook and Twitter this week that he was, quote, actively exploring the possibility of running for president, blah,
right.
blah, blah. I am not a fan, and I have not been a fan of Jeb Bush's for a long, long time. I think that the main argument from the salons, from the D.C. establishment and the strategists and the navel gazers in Washington and Manhattan, their argument will be that he has a solidly conservative record as Florida governor,
right.
And I think that they're going to use that as a shield to try and immunize him from criticism from the grassroots on the right on two of my defining national public policy issues, education and immigration. And on those issues, Jeb Bush finds himself in the same camp as many big government and big business progressives.
Right.
He's for Common Core, and he is squarely and unapologetically for some kind of mass legalization for millions of illegal aliens. He's also in support of massive expansions of temporary visas for H-1B holders, and I have to question the wisdom and the lack of principle in supporting these policies that are not good for American parents, not good for American students, not good for the current generation of American workers. And
how dare you?
Workers. I know.
How dare you question?
How dare I think about that?
The knowledge of the Bushes. You know, it's funny. We've never gotten more hate calls, Michelle, than, you know, I fill in for Bennett, Bill Bennett. He has a morning show that he runs nationally, and he takes Fridays off. So Bill Bennett has never been on air in Detroit ever. And I mentioned one time that he, you know, actually sat on the floor with Jeb Bush supporting Common Core, and that I think Bennett's a good guy. I think Bush is actually, I think he's probably a good man. But I do think Common Core is one of those litmus tests. I don't think there are any litmus tests that should determine whether you're a conservative or not. But I think, you know, obviously abortion is one. But Common Core is one of those things. It's as close to a litmus test, I think, that we have for Republicans to see if they actually believe in constitutional parameters of government. And I don't know if I'm the only one who thinks that. I just think it's a really good barometer, and it's so telling that you mentioned that with Bush.
Yes, well, you said that very well. And I've been reporting on Jeb Bush's spearheading and profiting from Common Core
sure.
for years now. I've talked about how he's used his nonprofit, the Foundation for Educational Excellence, sounds so good, doesn't it? as a way to
it doesn't sound bad.
As a way to pander to corporate interests, many of whom are benefiting from the Common Core racket and the taxpayer-funded monopoly of textbooks and testing companies that have been behind this.
Right.
And I think it's not just that he has been at the forefront of something that goes against the grain of cherished principles of local autonomy and sovereignty over educational issues, the constitutional principles, obviously, that you just mentioned. But
right.
It's also the way in which that he's dealt with opponents. And it has this progressive, elitist feel to it, the way he has attacked grassroots parents in Florida and the rest of the country who have realized
well,
that
I want to get on that
privacy undermining privacy sabotaging racket. That's all it is.
Right. Well, I want to, because you touched on that, and a lot of people don't know that, and they think that I'm just being anti-establishment for the sake of it. And I think you've gotten that a lot too, Michelle. A lot of people don't give you enough credit. You know, the libertarians who just wanted to smoke a bunch of pot, I think, were then surprised when you came out and you had a very reasoned view on medical marijuana, and they're like, well, now we have to find another reason to hate her. and the same thing with me. You know, I talk about this a lot. You mentioned specifically Jeb Bush in the Bush family. And by the way, wartime president, I have all the respect in the world for President George W. Bush with 9/11. So let me preface it with that. But you mentioned him attacking activists, you know, essentially the mom who was against Common Core. A lot of people don't know that. Maybe for the listener who doesn't know, tell us about that, because it can get ugly.
Yeah, well, I think the best thing to do for listeners who are not familiar with his long record on this is to go to my website at michellemalkin.com and
Ding.
Just type in the search engine, Common Core Jeb Bush,
yeah.
And you'll find snitfit after snitfit of Jeb Bush accusing parents like me, and there are millions of us, who have on-the-ground experience with the how Common Core has usurped local control, sabotaged already pre-existing standards of academic excellence in our own backyards and local communities,
right.
And how he has attacked us for opposing academic excellence and not knowing what's best for our own children. And it's that kind of nanny state elitism that obviously we expect from the left, from Hillary Clinton and No Child Left Behind, and It Takes a Village and all that. But for someone who pretends to be a promoter of school choice, and that is how Jeb Bush has captured the hearts of so many establishment Republicans and establishment GOP pundits on the East Coast, and for him to not see that these two things cannot, it's cognitive dissonance. You cannot be for school choice and Common Core at the same time. It's insane.
I think my brain just had an aneurysm for a second. I don't fully process that. It's true. It's one thing. Listen, everyone wants schools to be better, right? Everyone wants kids to do better in school. They want kids to learn more. What people don't understand, and you've written about this so much at your website, for those who haven't, go to michellemalkin.com. It's a federal power grab, and the federal government doesn't know how to best educate your children, better than, you know, Michelle Malkin knows how to educate her children, but then your state and your municipality, and to remove that ability, to remove that authority from municipal governments, that's a big power grab with which conservatives shouldn't be comfortable. So when I see someone like a Jeb Bush or a Bill Bennett out there really actively supporting it, how do you think they expect to rally the conservative base, or do they just not care?
They don't care, and I think it's because there has been such a lack of accountability,
mm-hmm.
and the fact that, you know, I think there are a lot of loyal grassroots conservatives out there who have swallowed hard in so many of the past presidential election cycles, and
yeah.
They've been sold on the idea that, well, we need someone who's more reasonable sounding and pragmatic, and we can't have a figure. We can't have actually somebody who has put the pedal to the metal on the conservative principles, because, oh, that won't be palatable. Well, how did that work out with Bob Dole?
Oh, gosh.
How did that work out with John McCain?
Michelle, hold on 1 second. We have to go to break, and I want to bring you back because you are on fire. Stay tuned. Louder with Crowder, Michelle Malkin. And we're back with the one and only Michelle Malkin, who was on fire. Firstly, credit to you for bringing out a Bob Dole reference in 2014. I can't remember the last time I heard his name.
Bob Dole.
Bob Dole, says Bob Dole. He's just sitting in his pants watching that Britney Spears Pepsi commercial saying Bob Dole. Who told him it was a good idea to do the Viagra? Was it Viagra commercial that he did?
Yeah.
I don't know. So, you know, what's funny is there's some Karl Rove type behind the scenes going, no, this is going to be great for you, kid. No one can touch you. The Viagra commercial with Britney Spears. That's the new Republican Party. And then we're looked at like we're the idiots because we believe in common sense values and limited government. I want to pivot, Michelle, because this is something you wrote about recently, again, at michellemalkin.com, though I don't want to be insensitive, because when I talk about these issues, my white privilege is showing as a male. Michelle Obama went through a very traumatizing incident at Target, where she was talking about how racial tensions are still alive, and someone asked her to help her get something from the shelf. I don't want to be inaccurate, because, Michelle, you have more of a minority past than I do, so perhaps you can explain for the listener.
Yeah, that's right. I've got the brown skin privilege,
you
and I'm going to invoke it right now, Steve. this whole episode is ridiculous on its face and offensive when you scratch the surface just a little bit.
Right.
So Mrs. Obama had this exclusive interview with People magazine. The context is important here because she was trying to show she was down with the struggle of the post-Ferguson agitators.
Right.
So she illuminated all of these specific horrific examples of the vestiges of racism that still exist and that both she and her privileged husband still suffer from.
Right.
So she talked about this very famous, infamous now, it turned infamous, incident a couple of years ago in 2012 when she supposedly went on incognito to be among the regular moms at Target.
Yeah.
And some shopper asked her to go reach the detergent high up on the shelf. And all of a sudden, this thing has morphed into an example of her being an oppressed martyr and symbol of racial discrimination. Although, when she first recounted this story on the David Letterman show shortly after the Target visit, it's very strange. You can go watch the video where she related the same anecdote as just a nice little example of how she
sure.
could be among the hoi polloi. What happened here? An incredible tall tale of racialized victimhood. And the thing is, Stephen, I wrote about this in Culture of Corruption. I did a whole chapter on Michelle Obama where I talked about this penchant that she has for spinning these tales of racial oppression for political gain.
She's very good at it.
She's been doing it since she was at Princeton University, and I read her thesis. It was called Princeton Educated Blacks and the Black Community, and she talked about how she was being marginalized by the lily white academic tower, the ivory tower, and how she had suffered afterwards, after she graduated, with the lily white corporate world, when in fact
right.
she's benefited time and time again from the largesse of the American dream, and all she can do is whine about it all the way to the tippy top of the ladder of opportunity.
I don't know if I'm comfortable with this, because people are going to see this on YouTube and you're not on camera. It's just me, this large white man, and people will associate what you're saying, and you can say it, but I can't say it. They're going to blame me, and it'll, in quotation, say Michelle Malkin. You know, I honestly, if I were in a store, I'll be honest, okay, Michelle. Firstly, I would never ask you to get something on the top shelf, because I would imagine that you'd be challenged. And that's racist. I get it. Believe me, it's not lost on me that I'm a racist jerk, okay? But Michelle Obama is constantly walking around. Everything is sleeveless, right? She wants to show you the horseshoe tricep she has going on. So if I'm just looking for someone who looks like they are of good stock to help carry something heavy from a high shelf, she's got the reach, and she's obviously showing her arms. I would think that it'd be complimentary for me to say, hey, sweetheart, you've got great arms. Do you think you could help me carry something heavy? And I just realized sweetheart is also sexist. I say it all the time to my wife, and I just realized now I'll be condemned for that. But, you know, I mean, it seems to me, I can't imagine someone construing that as racist. Do we even know if this guy was white who asked her? Did she ever clarify?
It was a woman.
Oh, it was a woman. That's right.
Yeah, and of course, the second, you know, another point here is the reason why you wouldn't ask me to get you anything is because I'm 5'1", and Michelle Obama is 5'11". Oh, you know, the idea that it's Jim Crow all over again because some shorter person asked her to go reach the detergent on the top shelf.
Well, if that's true, then every recruiter for the WNBA needs to be hauled out in cuffs. I mean, hey, you're tall, and, you know, we need you to shoot a jumper over another, effectively, what is a giant. If they would have described Michelle Obama or my wife in the Old Testament, they would have been a giant, right? 5'11 for a woman is incredibly tall. She's like the Bumble in Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer putting the star on the Christmas tree. I just, you know.
Well, you know, ultimately, I think what this shows is it's not about the color of the skin of Barack or Michelle Obama. It really is about the thinness of their skin. And, you know, setting aside that this is a completely tall tale, pun intended, the idea that somebody asking her for a favor is tantamount to an international human rights crime, it just shows you that the level of cynicism that just reeks, that marinates this whole identity politics culture that they're involved in.
Well, are you okay? Do you need to take a minute, or can you?
Can I ask you for one? That's not racist or sexist.
I don't know if it's racist or sexist. It's one of those things where it's, you know, I want to think that I'm not out of touch because I'm white, but I do understand there are certain things as a white male that I may not experience. You know, I fully grasp that. I fully comprehend that. I can never have the same experience in America as you did, you know, growing up. It's funny. You say brown. As a Filipino, you know, obviously there's usually people would say, you know, Asian's yellow. Is Filipino separated into brown if you're going to go into a color?
Yeah. I'm a little brown woman, don't you know?
I guess I don't see it that way, but I guess. But you're not like. Anyways, I was going to say.
Well, I think it's because it's Southeast Asia. But you know, in any case, I think the thing that I've learned from my days at you know, wacky Oberlin College, and for the last quarter century, really dealing with identity politics left, is they have to reach. So far and so hard, and they end up fabricating so much of the discrimination. They need to do it. I mean, Oberlin is a cesspool of racial hoaxes, and I think that there is a connection here to all of the gender hoaxes that we're seeing as well, with all of the you know, these hyped rape claims that are falling apart, and it's been happening for years and years now. I think the difference is that, and this is heartening to me, Stephen,
right,
that more and more people, whatever their color, are willing to and more courageous about just calling it out and not apologizing for it. Man, you got to stop apologizing for your pallor. Come on.
Yeah. I think this is your last segment on Ladder with Crowder because you're a little racist. That's what I think. I'm not even going to lie to you about it. I will say this, Michelle. So now you... I can never reveal a woman's age, but you're older than I am. I think I can say that without coming across as disrespectful. It depends on who you're talking with. Sometimes I'll have people freak out at me. But you're older than I am. So you grew up, obviously, there were some racial tensions, you know, here in the States, if you're talking about the 60s. I get that, right? And there are people who were alive for that, and they haven't forgotten that. So I'm not insensitive to it. But my wife and I have talked about this, and all of my friends and I have talked about this. Being raised in a post-racial America, you know, being born in the 80s, right? There is no systemic, established form of discrimination. There hasn't been in my lifetime, okay? So that's the America I've been raised in. I just say that to preface it. My wife and I and every single friend my age have agreed that racial tensions have never been worse in our lifetime. Now, is that something that you would feel is mirrored with someone from your generation, or would your kids say that, or is it just really a purely millennial thing? Because we all agreed racial tensions are worse now than ever because of stories like this where it's constantly brought up, where you have to look at everything through the lens of race.
Yeah, Since it's something that I've been so steeped in, whether it's in academia or having worked at liberal newspapers and worked in, you know, at the ground zeros of racial tension. I was in Los Angeles at the time of the Rodney King riots, for example, and there have been so many of these paroxysms that Al Sharpton has been involved in. I wouldn't necessarily say that it's worse than it's ever been, but
okay.
There's definitely a feeling under the age of Obama of having to tiptoe and the political correctness being, 11 on the meter. And it's poisonous in large part because we have a person in office at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue who got there and whose wife got to where she is by milking and stoking that racial tension and racial hatred and the double standards. We never talk about the systemic race, and these people in Washington never talk about the systemic racism that's involved, for example, when the government is doing it and actively discriminating against
right.
people in the name of equality. And I think that the lack of truly candid and honest discussion about race is probably one of the most shameful developments of public policy in the public square in the last 25 years.
Well, yeah, you're right. And it's the racism, really, of soft expectations when you're talking about that.
Yes.
And you know, it's funny. I was raised, and a lot of people get mad because I'm white American, so it's automatically, you know. Like I said, there are certain things that I'm completely insensitive to, but you also have to understand I'm not a white American. I'm an English-speaking Canadian who was raised in French Canada, where they thought I was learning disabled until the third grade because I legally was not allowed to attend English schools. And it turned out, you know, French is my first language. I learned to read and write. But then, you know, obviously we spoke more English at home. And that's the way I think. I think in English. So I was a step behind everyone because I was doing geography in French. I was doing math in French. You know, I can't open Stephen's Diner because apostrophe S.
Mm-hmm.
is an English form of spelling. There is systemic discrimination in a place like Quebec. I've experienced it. And for someone here in the States to act as though there's that same kind of government institutionalized discrimination, it's a real reach. And so people don't make that reach. They make the reach that someone asked me to help them at Target, therefore they're a Klansman. I mean, that's how far
yeah.
we've come. And it's great to always hear people like you who don't take the BS, but I'll tell you what, as a little brown woman, I'm using your terminology here, I think this, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, before Barack Obama, everything was race, and it's still been that way, right? Because it's time for a black president. If you don't vote for him, you're a racist. And now everything is war on women, with Lena Dunham faking lying about the rape to the Virginia case, lying about rape. I think the reason they're doing this war on women thing right now is they're setting the stage for Hillary, war on women, sexism. If you don't vote for her, you're a sexist. Do you see, or someone like an Elizabeth Warren, because I think it'll be a female candidate. Do you see that, or am I just being crazy, conspiratorial white guy?
No, I'm in the conspiracy camp with you.
Okay.
I definitely see it. I mean, these progressives always play the long game, and grievance politics has always been their ticket, and they've seen it work in the past. Now, I would have to say that during the midterms, we finally saw some pushback, and here
yeah.
in Colorado, where I live, Cory Gardner was somehow able to trump those cards. And maybe there's something that other Republicans can learn from that. I think the fact that he never winced or cringed when these ridiculous arguments were being made was very effective. And also mockery. You know, we had Mark Udall here, who is this decrepit old machine Democrat politician, and when you had even the liberal media mocking him for all of the war on women stuff and calling
right.
him Mark Uterus, something is happening.
You can't say that on the air. That's not allowed. This airs on terrestrial radio, Michelle. You can't say you.
We can't say.
Yeah, you can't say that. It's scatological, apparently.
Yeah. Well, in any case, the thing is that they've worn out their welcome. You know, even among
right.
the mainstream, and that's a good development.
No, I think you're right. I think they've worn out their welcome politically, but I do think culturally they are bombarding young women right now with this idea that. You know what's funny? If this were the case, Michelle, if all white men had a secret meeting behind everyone's back. And by everyone, I mean everyone who's not a white male. And we said, okay, we hate everyone who's not us, right? We don't even like women, right? Ready, break. If that meeting took place, I must have gotten, my invitation must have been lost in the mail.
Lost in the mail.
Because the funny thing is, and like when I said earlier, you know, I said sweetheart. Why is it now that if I say thank you, sweetheart, it's a term I use. Why is it that I'm assumed I either want to rape that person or oppress that person? And I didn't just mean thank you, sweetheart. That's where we've come as America. I mean, it's got to be a shift for you. I mean, people have always been horrible because I grew up in the generation where everyone had the YouTube comment section. So everything just devolves into the worst that humanity has to offer right away. Mm-hmm. But we assume the worst in everybody now. Sometimes sweetheart means sweetheart. Sometimes, hey, can you help me with this at Target means I need some help. Is that so far-fetched?
Apparently. And you did such a brilliant job answering that that viral, you know, horrible catcall video with your trip to the mall. And, you know, in the heartland, in normal America, thankfully, common courtesies are still treated as such. But, you know, everything becomes, this political grievance Olympics among these people, and whether it's Michelle Obama or Lena Dunham, and in increasing measures now these enabling journalists who just ignore the facts to ply their false narratives.
Right.
And I think it shows why it's so important that you are where you are, fighting in, fighting in the podcast space, fighting on YouTube, to try and get some rebalancing that of common sense that we all need.
Well, the real reason is my employers looked at the actuary tables and realized that I didn't quite appeal to the 73-year-old male who was buying self-lubricating pocket catheters.
Yeah, you're right.
So I said, I guess it's podcast and YouTube for me, but derp, derp. But I'm glad that your children are listening or they're seeing stuff and
absolutely.
I can provide some stuff for them. I mean, that's the thing. And Michelle, I know, you know, you have obviously written books and you've used traditional mediums as well. But what you've done with so many sites, people don't realize. I mean, Hot Air, Twitchy, and your own website. I mean, you made these mammoth sites before mammoth news sites existed. So sometimes people might think because you actually stick to your guns, you know, oh, she's kind of old, corny Michelle Malkin. She's really stuck on her ways. Like, no, people don't realize the amount of influence you've had on new media. You and Andrew Breitbart, it's staggering, and I hope our listeners can appreciate that, because I mean, man, it's something I don't know if I can do. A few thousand people are listening to this on a podcast after it runs terrestrially, but Twitchy, Hot Air, Michelle Malkin, I mean, you've had your hands in so many things. How did you know, the old Wayne Gretzky quote is, don't go where the puck is, go where the puck's going to be. How are you so able to see where the puck's going to be so effectively?
Well, I think just being plugged in and having my ear to the ground and, you know, doing what you're doing, which is not getting stuck in bubbles.
Right.
And, you know, that's a problem not only for a lot of people who work in our business, but, you know, for the conservative, for the GOP establishment.
Right.
Writ large, and it's important to be in this space. I mean, you know, winning, being here is half the battle,
right.
And realizing that the world is so much bigger than a few cable news stations and a few mainstream media outlets.
Well, I hate to cut you off,
right?
But there is, yes, you are absolutely right, and I hate to cut you off, but there is no small brown lady I would rather ride into battle with. Maybe that little chick from The Incredibles who made the costumes. She seemed like she would probably be pretty good in a foxhole. But Michelle Malkin, thank you so much for being here. And last show of the year, so we hope to have you get back here in 2015.
Always my pleasure.